Tá mar as ar ís inniu ag Patrick Boyce a gada gart agus tá mar gali inniu písa ar bhí mynd a cantir ar chop a bhí a gehe a hasi a hei agus a hein a gobi an bíant a gilioras a gobi a fóil sa chop a sgarapi tá mar garhart ar as ar ís ag nar a hasi tú Patrick you then started to buy the radios first, was that it like?
That's right, yes. The first radio that I sold, I got it from Brian McGinley over in the Doe Cooperative in Chrysler.
Right.
And I bought it from him and I sold it, and then I decided that I would go into business myself on radios, you know. So I bought radios from the Marconi Company in Dublin, HMV. And first of all, I bought a half a dozen, and then I bought a dozen, and then finally, I got an extra 5% when I bought four dozen.
Thank
God. So one evening, the Swally lorry arrived, and Henry Cullen started taking on radios onto the street. And my father was there, and Kerton and himself and Hughie Kerr, his helper, they're both taking on the radios. And my father was watching, and he says, Patrick, he says, God save us and bless us, he says, you'll never sell all those radios. And they kept carrying on the radios till there was 48 radios on the street. And my father wasn't too happy at all.
But you took the gamble, Patrick, fair play to you, you know.
He says, you'll never sell those all. So that evening I put four radios into the car and I went to fan it.
Four?
Four radios, you know.
Right.
And sold those four radios that night.
No problem, do you?
And every evening after that I had to get on the road to fan it, because I got a month to pay for the radios. And I had to get the money in before my father would have to pay for the radios.
So you went off every evening across?
Across to Fannett, and I sold six dozen radios in Fannett that winter. That was when the ESB came into Fannett, yeah. You know.
What year would that have been roughly?
That would be around the late 50s.
Yeah.
Late 50s it would be.
What kind of price would they have been?
Well, the cost me 12 guineas. And they were sold at 16 guineas. But I got an extra 5% when I took the quantity,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But so word went out and fan it, and everybody, you know, I have a radio.
Oh, yeah. It went from house to house, just people to tell you, oh, those people there have no radio. They have an old battery one, you know. And I would have to buy the old radio, you know, and then I would have to sell it.
Oh.
But I would do it up, kind of, you know,
right.
Clean it up and...
That was the deal.
Yes,
you bought their old radio.
But then you had to sell that one then, where there was no ESB.
Right.
You see.
Ah, yeah.
But, and then I went into televisions after that. And I sold a lot of televisions. And Fannett, Remelton, Rathmullen, Dunfanaghy, Chrysler, and round home here. And then...
Would that have been gone into the early 60s then?
Perhaps? Yes.
Yeah.
But then you had to do some repairs then. There was a lot of trouble. You had to go up in chimneys, you know, and put up lashings around the chimney and put up the aerial. A lot of trouble with the TVs or it, you know.
And I suppose at the time you would only get reception of RTs.
Some areas you had a very poor reception. You had to put the aerial very high. Then there were other places... You could put up in the street, maybe, you know, kind of.
You'd only get at the time maybe just RTs 1 and 2, and
that's right, yes. And BBC too as well, you know. But sold a lot of TVs around the country already.
The black and white TVs.
Black and white, 17-inch Bush they were, you know. But they were a very good TV now, you know.
They would last a lot longer than the ones you get nowadays, though.
They would. Some of them were going up to a few years ago there, you know.
Yeah.
Especially the radios now, the Bush. Sold Bush radios too as well.
And see the maintenance, did you then have a workshop here?
No. it was mostly changing valves, you know, and maybe switches and stuff like that. But I did that all myself. But any major repairs, I would get Joe Deehan, God rest him, he's dead now. Joe Deehan and Letterkenny, he did all my repairs, any that I couldn't do myself. So maybe I'd go up to him and maybe live in 3 or 4 TVs at a time, and he'd repair them for me and call back in a week. He was very good at the radios and TVs, Joe. But he died a few years ago there.
Right. But you also went across in your earlier days, across to Fannet.
That was, it'd be 1942 to 45, roughly. The telegrams for Fannet, for Ballyhearn and all around there, would come to the Kerrygaard post office. And brother and myself, Columba, we went to Fannet. We'd go across in the boat, you know, with a bicycle, and cycled to Ballyhearn and lived there.
There was a wee ferry going across from
Kerrygaard. There was a ferry, the McElhinney's had a ferry there.
Right.
But we didn't have to pay, because the post office paid them for.
Right. So but you took your bikes on. And
we took the bike on and delivered the telegram to Ballyhearn post office to Mrs. Doherty there. The post office has closed up there within this last few months, actually.
I've been down in Ballyhearn not that long ago, just.
Yes, well, it's closed up. There's no shops in Ballyhearn now at all.
Shops closed down too.
Yeah. But we got a shilling for delivering the telegram there. And as well, we'd deliver the telegrams to Rosapenna Hotel, and we got a shilling at the Rosapenna Hotel for delivering down there, which is a lot easier.
Yeah, because it was closer.
It was only about mile and a half or 2 miles down there, you know.
There was an easy earning.
It was a lot easier earning a shilling there now, you know. So
that has brought big changes now with the bridge going across to Mulray. Like.
Oh, it has brought a lot of changes, all right. Kerrygaard has benefited greatly.
Of course it has, yeah.
All the shops mm-hmm. have benefited from the bridge. As the Ballyhearn ones and Leahid there can be over 5-10 minutes over in Kerrygaard, but it would take them a lot longer going to Kerrykeel or Tamney.
Yeah. Going up as far as Milford. And
yes. Yeah. That's right, yeah. So that's a long journey to go to shop, because all the shops are closed in Ballyhearn now there. No shops in Ballyhearn at all.
But would the roads though are quite bad over in
There's still bad roads over in Ballyhearn, you know. But the road from the bridge in is very good now.
Oh, the road's brilliant.
It's very good now. All right. So a lot of the Ballyhearn and Leahid and Glensk people are all coming to Kerrygaard to do their shopping there. And you have the chemist shop, and you have the hairdressers, two hairdressers. You have the credit union and the doctor, the church, everything. They have everything here that they want, you know.
You've gained on this side, no doubt. We'll go back to that ferry McElhinney's were running.
Yes. There were three generations of the McElhinney's. I had the ferry there. And the last ones that rode across there would be the last lady would be Ruby McElhinney. She's now living in Remilton.
I've seen her name in the paper, you know, just when the
bridge. Ruby McCloy, her husband died about a year ago there.
When that bridge was about to open, I remember.
That's right, she was down at the opening, you know, she was invited there.
So she rode across.
She rode across. She was a very good rower. And she had huge, great arms.
Gosh, she would,
she was very strong. Yeah. But she could row, I can tell you now, you know.
And then what about on the Fannet side? Was there another ferry coming from Fannet across? Like,
No. Just McElhinney's had the only ferry.
Yeah.
And at night would flash a lamp or something on the other side, you know. And then the postman went over at 11:30 and he came back at about 1 o'clock. And they knew the time that the postman was going over and coming back. So people would go over and back at that time, you know, kind of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Then the people from Ballyhearn and around there cut turf up in Minahoo in the mornings, would all come over in the boat with their turf spades tied on the bicycle, you know, and they would cycle up to cut the turf, and then they'd take the turf back home in boats.
So, how big was that ferry though?
Oh, it would take maybe, it was only a small boat, you know.
Right.
It would take maybe 8 to 10 people at a time, maybe, you know. That's about the height of it.
Patrick, you then went on for a while to, you ran a taxi service, did you not?
Yes, I had a taxi plate, and I had a driver's license too as well. Hackney badge, you know.
Yeah.
And I used to drive to the dances. And I drove to Letterkenny, Mudford, Chrysler. One time I was going to Chrysler, I had a Ford Anglia car, a two-door Ford Anglia. The registration number was AH4717. And I drove to dances for this car, but this night I was going to Chrysler to dance to McCafferty's Hall in Chrysler. And I went out to the Mulroy Crossroads to collect two people there. And when they got in, I had 11 people in the car. And I came in as far as Tirlahan, and a cousin of mine and his girlfriend, Patrick Boyce of Cranford, were standing at a gate there looking for a lift. So I stopped and I said to him, Patrick, I says, I can't lift you. I said, I have a full load on. There's no room in the car. Aye, he says, Patrick, he says, we'll get in. We'll get in all right, you know. So I said, well, if you can get in, I said, you can come, I said. So they all got out in the back seat, and Patrick got in first and piled them all on top, and they were lying across, Patrick and up and down every way. And there was 13 in the car. And on the road to Chrysler, I had to drive 15 to 20 miles an hour because the back bumper was hitting, every bumper went over, went down, hit the road.
It's strange that the car moved at all.
I had to drive very easy altogether. But I had extra reliefs, and the side springing was in those Ford Anglias, so I had an extra relief on each side, in the back end, you know. But I got rid of a few of them on the way home. Pat Goller took on a 3 or 4 of them on me, for me, you know.
Right. But there weren't many taxis running that time, though.
No, at that time, petrol was very scarce too, you know, during the war. And only people that were given essential services, like doctors and teachers and school teachers, I think, doctors mostly, you know, and priests, they got coupons for petrol. And my mother got some, but she had, she wanted all hers, she had to drive to Mulford to teach
she
up
was
there.
Teaching, yeah.
And, but I got coupons from a local man here that was driving turf from Gidore up to near the border.
Out to St. Johnson's?
To St. Johnson is right. Yeah. And sometimes he would go on the tear, you see, you know. he got a lot of coupons, you see, more than he needed really, because he was driving the turf all the time. But maybe for a week or two he'd go on the tear and he wouldn't be driving at all, you see. And he was from the town here. And he used to come down to the shop, and I'd be behind the counter, and he wouldn't come into the shop, but he would stand out in the street and he would just do that there, you see, you know, with his finger for me to come out. And we'd go into a wee oil house that we had down the shop there, and we'd close the door, and he'd get this book of coupons, you see, you know. And he would say, what do you want? So I would take all the coupons he had, and he charged me a shilling for each coupon. And people didn't know where I was getting the petrol from at all, because I was driving away at dances and everything, and I'd be saying, where's Boyce getting the petrol at all, you know? So
that was the answer.
I never told them where I was getting the coupons from, you know.
But even your car then, would they be quite heavy on juice?
Not really. But you see, the speed of those cars only about 30 mile an hour, yeah. You know. You think that was fast at that time.
Oh, I suppose, you know? Yeah.
40 was very fast,
yeah.
You know. And going over bumps, you had to slow down, yeah. Going over bumps, you'd hit your head in the roof.
The roads were bad, though.
The roads were very bad and narrow at the time, you know.
So the dance halls then, Patrick, you
I got in free to all the dancers because all I had to do was show my badge, the Hackney badge, you know.
Right.
And you'd get in free if it was half a crown or 1 and 6 pence. If you're driving a load, you always get in free to all the dancers.
So no wonder you got into this dancing. You're into ballroom dancing?
Yeah, Patrick. I'm into ballroom dancing now, yes, that's right. And travel to Donegal, Lufford, Strabane, Letterkenny. Letterkenny, Milford, and I have, for the ballroom dancing, I have up to silver medal. I was in Ballyshannon in 2003, and I did a medal test there. And the examiner was Mr. Osborne, an ex-European champion. And I had to dance 3 dances in Dorian's ballroom in Ballyshannon with a lady from Letterkenny. And I had to dance the quick step, the foxtrot, and the slow waltz after one another. And there was nobody allowed into the ballroom except the examiner and the two of ourselves. And I had some supporters up from Letterkenny, and he wouldn't allow them in to watch. As he said, they would put me off, you know, put us off to dance. But I would prefer to have the money to watch in, you know.
Yeah, and of course.
It was a huge, big ballroom, you know. Yeah. But I got a certificate from the National Association Teachers of Dancing. And I got 87.5 for the quick step and 87.5 for the slow waltz and 85 for the foxtrot out of 100. So I have the certificate still.
You did very well, Patrick. You know?
So that was my dancing experience, yeah. You know. So I still go to dances about twice a week.
Right.
Maybe Letterkenny or Strabane.
You'd be very fit, like, is there a wee group of same people go to?
Yes, same.
Travel to it.
Mostly ballroom dancers, you know. Yeah. And then when you go to Cranford or something, you just do ordinary dancing, you know, kind of.
And there's some dance coming up this weekend, you said?
I'm going to a class on Saturday night, you know, a ballroom class, starting in Letterkenny.
But there's not some charity dance coming up?
There's a charity dance tonight.
Tonight,
The old Milford Hall. It's a charity dance there.
You also have done very well on golfing, Patrick, and it's taken you all over the world.
I played in a lot of countries. I played in South Africa, I played Argentina, I played England, Scotland, and California, South Carolina, Florida. And I had an experience in Southampton 1 year. A friend of mine from Russell's Point, PJ Conmee, and myself went over to play in Southampton, some competition there. And on the Saturday, Manchester United and Southampton were playing, and we went to the match, went on the train to the match, and we had no tickets. It was a ticket game, but at the entrance to the ground there was these men selling tickets, you see. So we decided we'd buy one, but we thought there might be fake tickets. So I said to PJ, I said, we'll try one of the tickets. You stay with your man. And I went down and handed the ticket to the man in the turnstile, you see. So I got through, so I waved to him and told him to pay for 2 tickets. and he paid for the two tickets, and we were done. We got a lovely seat up in the stands, and we were there for about 5 minutes, and the game had started, and there came about 10 or 12 people in, and they looked at us and they said to us, he says, you're in our seats, you know. So I said, no, I said, we're not. I said, we had tickets, we bought tickets, and we wouldn't get up, you see, from our seats. So they went back and they got some of the officials, and they came back, and the officials said we'd have to get out of the seats, because these the tickets were stolen the night before out of the office, manager's office, and we had to get out of our seats, and we were taken down to the office, and there was policemen there, and they questioned us about where we got the tickets, because at that time it was a very bad time for Irish people to be in England, you know.
Oh,
I mean,
I know.
Two Irishmen down in Southampton, yeah. What were they doing, you know? Mm-hmm. So they questioned us what we were doing over, thought we were from the IRA or mm-hmm. something, you know. So we told them that we were over playing golf, and well, they said these tickets were stolen the night before from the office, and we were questioned where we were from and what we were doing and all the rest, and they believed us to the finish up, and then asked us where we bought the tickets. So we told them from a stout man outside the grounds. So this man says, oh, he says, I know that man, he's here at every Manchester United Southampton game. And he sells the tickets all the time, you know, wherever he gets them. But they were stolen the night before. I think it was 12 tickets were stolen out of the office.
So you didn't get to see the match?
So one of the officials took us away down through passages, through offices and whatnot, you know, managers, past the manager's office and other offices, and took us onto the pitch again. And we were directly behind the BBC camera. Then we had a very good seat there.
You got a better seat.
We got a better seat then, you know. But it was nerve-wracking, the whole
thing. It was,
thing,
of course,
you know.
Yeah. You're getting a grilling from the...
Oh, got a grilling, all right, you know. But a bad time to be in England,
of
just,
course.
You know.
What did you think of the Manchester United team at that time? They must have been good.
Well, they were good, all right, you know. They were very good. They beat Southampton that day, you know. But it was a great match, all right.
Who are the players that stand out in your memory?
Oh God, that time, I suppose it was, I think it was Bobby Styles, and I can't really remember now the names, you know, just.
Were they the Busby Babes, like, or?
They would have been the Busby Babes at that time, yes.
Mm-hmm. Duncan Edwards. And
pardon?
Duncan Edwards.
I wasn't probably a United supporter. I wasn't into football very much.
But you enjoyed just the day.
I was more into golf at that time, you know.
Yeah. But you won also the British Open, you said.
No, I competed in the British...
You competed.
The British Seniors Amateur Open.
Right.
Which was held in Portrush in 2001. It was a great experience. And I played there, and I was playing with... an American playing of plus one, a very good player, and an Englishman. And the American's caddy was his son, and he was playing of plus two. So it was in very high company, I can tell
you,
you know.
Yeah.
But I was playing of a low handicap at that time myself as well. But I didn't get into the last day, but I was watching the papers, but this American was 10th overall. There was over a thousand playing in that. Sorry. No. It was... They were from all over the world, from there, from Japan, Australia, Canada, all over. They were all very good players now, you know.
And you still play golf? You know?
I'm still playing. I held the course record in Rosapenna from 1992 to 96. The par is 70 in Rosapenna, and I went round in 3 under, which was 67 gross, and I held the course record for 4 years, and then Enda McMenamin from Ballymafia, an ex-pro, recognised.
He's the son of Senator?
No. He's the son of Joe McMinnum, the contractor.
All right.
He's an ex-pro. He's back in the amateur ranks again, you know. But he broke my record by one shot. He had a 66 gross. So I was very happy. But I played an exhibition match against Philomena Garvey from Dublin. She was the British ladies open champion at the time. But at that time she was past her best that I played. But I played an exhibition, yeah. Rosa Pena. And I was two up on her when the game was called off on account of rain. It started pouring down. And there was a lot of spectators there too as well. So they all went into the hotel afterwards, you know, and I went home. But she was the top player in Britain at that, years ago, but yeah. She was past her best when I played her.
I know. Patrick, tell me the story about when you played in Ballycastle. You play in golf in Ballycastle.
I played in the Blackbush tournament in the north, which is played over four courses. And I played, it was in the 90s. And this day I was playing in Ballycastle, and I was playing with a Scotchman and an Englishman. And the first hole in Ballycastle is a dogleg around the river. And we drove off and I birdied the first hole, which is a par 5. We came to the second hole and I drove off first, and my ball went behind a tree. And it was a dogleg to the right, and there was a graveyard in front of me. And I hit the ball and it went straight into the graveyard, running like a rocket into the graveyard. And the next thing I saw was the ball coming out of the graveyard again, and it came out twice as fast as it went in. And you know where it landed? It landed up on the edge of the green, which was just right angles, you know.
Yeah.
And the Englishman said to me, he says, "God, Patrick," he says, "you're a lucky man today," he says. He says, "you're after birdieing the first hole, and now," he says, "you're out of bounds, and now you're up on the edge of the green." So I said to him, "There's I have a relation buried in that graveyard in there." And the Englishman says, "Ah," he says, "you're after telling me that you're from Northern Eagle up on the edge of the Atlantic, as far north as you can go." And he says, "How in the hell," he says, "could there be a relation of yours buried up in Ballycastle?" "Well," I says, "there is certainly a relation of mine." "Well," he says, "do you know his name?" I says, "surely I do." So I said, "his name was Rick O'Shea." And for a minute, your man stood, and the next thing, he says, "Rick O'Shea," he says. And he started laughing, but he laughed the whole way around the course after that.
It came to you fairly quick, Patrick.
I was stuck for a minute, and I thought, Rick O'Shea.
The ball ricocheted.
Well, I laughed the whole way around the course after
that. Oh, that was good.
Oh, God. I couldn't get over it anyway.
That was a good one, Patrick.
That was a good one, all right, yeah. I played in that Black Bush for years. But I haven't played in it now for a good few years. But that's the story of Ballycastle, yeah. Anyway, you know.
Patrick, you also built bikes.
After the war, we were agents for the Rally Bicycle in Rudge and Elswick, but couldn't get bicycles. You only got maybe a couple of bicycles in a month to sell, but you could get the parts all, you know. So I started building the bicycles from scratch. I got all the parts. The steel was been all used during the war, you know,
yeah.
For tanks and for rifles, yeah. And all the rest of it. And I built the bikes just out in the workshop there, and sold them off. But at that time, a rally bicycle was selling at £5.19/6. But you couldn't get them, they were very, very scarce, you know.
That money was hard come by, though.
Yeah, it was. But it's a good while to build a bicycle, you know.
Good, of course, you know.
I still remember the ball bearings that were used in the, ball bearings in the centre axle and the back axle were quarter inch ball bearings, and in the front axle there was 3/16 ball bearings. I still remember.
Your memory is good.
My memory is pretty good, all right, for that, or some things, just.
Yeah, I know. Patrick, you have a good story about an old woman down in Melmore as well, and Lord Leighton was trying to buy your house.
I'll switch it off a minute there, just to see. There's a story about Biddy Marley. Biddy Gallagher from Melmore, Downings. She had a very good horse. And Lord Leitrim, as the fifth Earl, heard about this great horse that she had. So he decided to go down to buy the horse, but he wasn't prepared to sell it, as she needed it to work the farm, you know. So one fine Leitrim arrived to see the horse. So Biddy took out the horse onto the street. And Lord Leitrim had a look at it, and he was very impressed with it. And every time Lord Leitrim lifted the horse's hoof, it took a jump. And he decided not to take the horse, as he thought the horse was too wild. But the reason that the horse jumped each time, Biddy had a 70 pin on the other side of the horse, which came in very handy. Every time that the horse, that Lord Leitrim lifted the horse, she gave it a prick with a pin. So
she held on to her horse.
So Lord Leitrim said that the horse was too wild, that he wouldn't take the horse.
He lost interest in buying
the horse. She was delighted to be able to keep the horse, you know.
Very good.
So Biddy kept her horse, and Lord Leitrim went home.
Good story. Patrick, would you like to tell me the... Quite a lot of songs were written about Lord Leitrim when he was murdered. Would you like to tell me one of them, please?
This is a song about the shooting of Lord Leitrim. This is the Lord Leitrim was shot at Wood Quarter near Cranford in 1878. And this is a song about the shooting of Lord Leitrim. Rejoice, ye men of Leitrim, no longer mourn the fate that held you in serf form on a villain's broad estate. The iron fist that bound you in slavery's hated claim shall never seize your earnings nor menace you again. No more that tyrant lord landlord shall rack rent and oppress, no more increase your misery nor add to your distress. The curses of his victims have fallen on his head, and the avenger's hand has set him to number with the dead. Lord Leitrim was a noble man. He owned a vast estate, and he ruled like a despot and earned the people's hate. 100,000 acres were subject to his sway, and he kept his suffering tenants and terror and dismay. The widow's prayers he laughed at, the orphan's tear despised. He rooted up their homesteads, and in poverty they died. He tramped in their sacred rites that earned their sweated toll, and he banished them in hundreds from Tyrconnell's holy soil. And Galway, as in Leitrim, his tyranny was felt. From both these western counties, he exterminates himself. The Donegal evictions and history mark a place, but it was here in Donegal they ended, the hoary sinner's race. It was on the road to Milford the armed avenger stood, and they wiped out injuries of years in that vile evictions. Eviction's blood. Who dares to say that's murder? Who dares to say that's wrong? For they read the land of Leitrim, who burdened it too long. Rejoice, ye men of Leitrim, Galway and Donegal, for that tyrant's blood was shed in vengeance for you all. You who suffered from his tyranny, You feared his dread command. You had to pay increased rents and do his will or be banished from his land. So no more that dreadful mandate will issue forth from him. He has paid the price of tyranny. As he lived, he died in sin. And the widow's ruined cottage near Cranford marks the spot where Leitrim fell, a blood corpse before a fanned shot. Here's to the men who did the deed. May their names be never known, only to the band of brothers who claim them as their own. In Donegal and Leitrim, let Irish men proclaim, and will you now please pray for those who ended the tyrant's reign. That's it.
Well put, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was well.
Do you know who composed
it? I do not know who composed that at all now. No.
Very good, Patrick.
Hmm?
Very good, I never heard it.
Yeah, well that's Lord Leitrim, all right, you know. He evicted a lot of people, evicted a lot of tenants down in Melmore, you know.
He did, yeah, I've heard of that, but didn't get any details about it, but I think he evicted all the tenants in Melmore.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Okay, Patrick, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. I think that's all I can.
That's not enough for today, maybe. Yeah. Patrick, would you like to tell me the story about the duck race?
The duck race, right. Well, there was a Father McHugh, a relation of ours from Chantilly near Cranford. He came home from China. He was one of the first priests, one of the first four priests that went to the missions of China, missions in China there. And he came home on holidays, and in 1936 he had sports up in Devlin Moor. In Doherty's Field, Tom Doherty's Field in Dublin Moor. And this day, my mother and myself went up to the sports. And he had a duck race, a real duck race there. And he had ducks in sacks, you know, tied up. And when the duck race came on, every young fella and young girl and woman about the place got a duck and a bag, and they got a stick too as well. And the ducks were put on the starting line, you see. It was a line, white line for the starting, and they got the ducks. My mother was racing a duck, and I was racing a duck along with a lot of other people. And they got the ducks out of the bags and put them on the starting line, but some of the ducks wouldn't go at all. Some of them went right, some of them went left, and some of them went back the way. And you couldn't steal, you got the stick and you tried to keep the duck straight around the head of the duck, you see, but the duck couldn't go straight at all. And it was only about 6 or 7 yards, but none of the ducks got to the finishing line at all.
But none of them?
Not at all, no, they were all over the place, you know, you couldn't steer a duck. But it was a big laugh, everybody, after a duck was stuck.
It was a fun day.
Oh, it was a fun day. But then there was races too, and egg and spoon race, and there was wheelbarrow race, and there was one race, I remember, it was a ladies' race, a married ladies' race, and I remember it was a Mrs. Cullen from Devlin Moor that won it. She was Dan Cullen's wife. And Maggie Doherty was second. Mrs. Cullen won the race. Maggie Doherty was second. She was, her husband was the railway lorry driver. And it was a fun day, all right. And there was a big gathering of people there.
Of course it was.
It was in Tom Doherty's Field, it was, you know.
But I'd say you'd have a lot of sport days at the time. And
the big day that time was the Cranford Sports. It was always on the 29th of June.
There'd be a lot of big gathering then.
There was a huge crowd there.
Yeah.
And there were stalls, selling sweets, ice cream, mm-hmm. Dulce, Carrigan Boss, you know. So that was the biggest day of the year.
The at the time, sports, yeah.
You know.
Okay, Patrick, I'll leave it there today.
Right.
And thank you for your time. And
okay, your you're welcome. Thank you.
Good morning.
I hope. So the next big day for me is the 19th of July for the Donegal Historical Society, so I have to get a lot of stuff ready for them.
You'll be lecturing or?
Yeah, there's yeah. about 40 or 50 of them coming from Derry and Donegal. You know?
Okay.
So I don't know whether I'll be up to it or not, you know.
Oh, you won't. Thanks, Patrick.